Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this fifth lecture in the series of the LSE centenary lectures run by the Law Department on Law and Society, tonight's topic being taxation, of course. We would like to make this lecture a special one and designate it as the Wheatcroft Memorial Lecture, in memory of the man who was responsible for putting tax on the map, and it all started here at the LSE. So I particularly welcome those from the Wheatcroft era, as the title of our lecture has it. I recognize many here tonight of those who have taught with him, edited, wrote, and everything else, and a particular welcome also to John Wheatcroft, his son, who is here this evening. I won't enlarge myself on Ash Wheatcroft's contribution to taxation, because if I did so, I would be trespassing on the ground which I hope will be covered by our speaker this evening, who is Andrew Park. He's one of the foremost members of the tax bar. He's a bencher of Lincoln's Inn, a former chairman of the Revenue Bar Association. He is often to be found sitting as a deputy high court judge. And dare I mention one of his earliest posts, that of temporary assistant lecturer at the LSE in the early 1960s under Professor Wheatcroft. And he's going to speak to us this evening on tax law in and after the Wheatcroft era. Andrew.
Well, thank you very much, John, for the introduction. And before I leap in, could I add my few words about how uplifting it is, actually, to see so many here this evening and so many old friends. I hope you won't all think you made a mistake and start walking out halfway through. I'm afraid I am proposing to read out the lecture which I have here, and fair warning, there are not going to be any breaks for the jokes or other light relief. But I've chosen, as my title, Tax Law in and After the Wheatcroft Era, pursuant to the invitation from John on behalf of the LSE to give a lecture in memory of Professor Wheatcroft, who died in 1987. I must say I was very greatly honoured to have been asked to give that lecture, or to give this lecture, and I'm even more honoured that it has been included in the series of lectures on the theme of law and society, which are being delivered over the current year to mark the centenary of the LSE. Now, G.S.A. Wheatcroft was known to his multitude of friends as Ash. He had a varied and consistently distinguished career during his working life. He was a practicing solicitor for a number of years, having qualified originally in 1929. Then he was a serving officer during the war and for a time after it. He returned to his solicitor's practice for 5 or 6 years. Then he became a Master of the Chancery Division, and he held that position from 1951 to 1959. In 1959, he became a professor of English law at this school, where he remained until 1968, retiring as Professor Emeritus thereafter. Then he was a director of life assurance companies until 1979, working with his former graduate students and his close friends, Mark, now Sir Mark Weinberg, and Sidney, now Sir Sidney Lipworth. I saw him a moment ago. He's here somewhere. Yes, nice to see you, Sidney. And after that, Ash lived mostly in retirement for the rest of his life, latterly with his son, John Wheatcroft, and can I add my own confirmation of what John has said, what a great pleasure it is to see John here this evening. Ash died in December of 1987. Now, despite his varied career and his many interests outside his working life, notably Chesson Bridge. And I think I remember being told that certainly in his younger days he was a pretty formidable golfer as well. His foremost specialization was the law of taxation. It's because of that that we're here this evening and that I'm standing at this rostrum delivering this lecture. Although I'm sure that in Ash's periods as a practicing solicitor, he had to deal with many areas of the law, and taxation was just one of them, nevertheless, tax law plainly had a special fascination for him, and he devoted himself to it to an extent that went far beyond merely dealing with the tax problems of his clients. This process of Ash immersing himself in tax law continued in the years when he was a Chancery Master and before he came to this school. In his working life as a master, I suspect he never had a single tax case to deal with. He'd be concerned with exciting questions such as whether the case should have been commenced by originating summons or by motion. All the same, during that time, he was establishing and consolidating his standing as the nation's foremost authority on the law of taxation. He published his first book in the field in 1953. That was a book which was described 34 years later by his obituarist in the British Tax Review as a revelation to practitioners. That obituarist, I may say, was Philip Lawton, sitting here, and it's a great pleasure to see Philip here this evening, as everyone else. The review was in the British Tax Review. Now, the British Tax Review was itself a Wheatcroft innovation in his years as a Chancery Master. It was the first academic and practical journal devoted to taxation, and Ash founded it as first editor in 1956. Well, as I've said, in 1959, he became Professor of English Law at this school, joining an already very distinguished department headed by Professor Jim Gower, seen here. It was, of course, visualized that Ash's field of academic specialization would be tax law, a field in which, in universities in the United Kingdom, no one had previously taken any interest. A little more about that coming up later. Now, it was during this period of Ash's life that I first had the immense good fortune to come into contact with him. In the mid-1960s, I was a new lecturer in the law department here, having managed after a bit to secure promotion from being temporary assistant lecturer, which is certainly what I was originally. And I'd conceived the idea of trying to acquire a specialization in tax. This brought me into close contact with Ash. I worked under his wing at a very important and really a very formative time in my career. He's definitely one of the most important persons ever in my working life. I admired and I revered him enormously then. I admire and I revere his memory equally enormously now. As it turned out, in my case, I didn't persevere as an academic lawyer in the tax field, but I crossed over into the field of practice. Few others did the same, including my friend and Ash's friend, Peter Whiteman, who's also here this evening. In fact, the careers of Peter and myself, I think he would agree, have followed pretty similar paths. I suspect that Ash may have been a little disappointed that Peter and I drifted out of the university world, but he never said so, and he was unfailingly encouraging to us in the courses which we followed. Anyway, tax law as a university subject is doing very well without us, and I'll have a little more to say about this also before I finish. Well, Chairman, as you know, I've entitled the lecture Tax Law in and After the Wheatcroft Era. My ambition is to attempt a a broad survey of the fundamental characteristics of the tax system as Ash first knew it, to trace from there what I perceive as the critical stages in its evolution to the way that it is now. And I'm going to look first at substantive law and then say something about the framework, the setting, if you like, administrative, professional, academic, in which the law of taxation takes its place. From time to time, I'll make some comments, sometimes about what Ash thought, or, as I believe, would have thought, and sometimes about what I think. So this is going to be one man's attempt, my attempt, I suppose, at a panoramic survey of the big trends in tax law over the last 60 years or so. Inevitably, there'll be omissions, and my own choices of the critical developments to pick out and comment on may not be, and in all probability will not be, the choices of many others. Inevitably, there'll be generalizations. I rather fear some of you might think that platitudes might be a more appropriate word. But anyway, that's in the nature of the theme that I'm going to set out to explore. So I'll start in the area of substantive law. And I'm planning to say something about the direct taxes first and indirect taxes later. As regards direct taxes, I'm going to start with those which apply to individuals and then go on and say something about those which apply to companies. I suppose, following convention in dividing taxes into direct taxes and indirect taxes. I do sometimes wonder how much validity there is in the distinction. One way of defining it might be that the direct taxes are those which are run by the Inland Revenue and the indirect taxes are those which are run by customs and excise. But I suppose a more refined principle is that a direct tax is one where the person who pays it to the fiscal authority is also the person who bears the burden of it, whereas an indirect tax is one where one person pays it, but the real burden is borne elsewhere. But even as I say that, people could quibble at that formulation. I'm sure everyone would take it for granted that Schedule E income tax is a direct tax, but under the PAYE system, it's of course the employer who pays it, whereas the employee bears the burden of it. Anyway, however all that may be, I haven't come here this evening to enlarge on whether there is or isn't a distinction between direct and indirect taxes, and certainly the only direct taxes, as we understand that term, that mattered for individuals when Ash started to get involved in tax were estate duty and income tax. Income tax, of course, included surtax. For companies, there was income tax and from 1937, profits tax as well, as it eventually became called. I'd like to say something about those various taxes and how things have moved on in their respective areas in subsequent years. So, starting with estate duty, it was introduced, as we all know, in 1894, and right down to the 1970s, it was the tax charged on the estates of persons who died. And as we all also know, on some deaths, as well as applying to the property which the deceased owned at his death, it also picked up some lifetime gifts, but not others, that he'd made before he died. Now, there have been very significant changes in the field of estate and gift taxation since. As it seems to me, there are four changes which are of the foremost importance And what I propose to do is to state them and then venture a few reflections on them. First, estate duty was replaced by capital transfer tax, CTT, in 1974 and 1975. Second, CTT was modified and remolded into inheritance tax in 1986. Third, the top rates have been very dramatically reduced. The top rate of estate duty in 1973 was 75%, and it was 80% only a few years before that. In 1974, the top rate of CTT, when it started, was set at the same level of 75%. That rate applied both to estates taxable on death and to gifts made in the donor's lifetime. Since 1988, in contrast, the top rate of inheritance tax for estates on death has been 40%, and for lifetime gifts, 20%. And there's also my fourth foremost change, that is that over the years, more and more reliefs and exemptions have been introduced. Now, reflecting on those changes, perhaps the first point to make is that 1894 to 1974, which is 80 years, of course, was a pretty long life for a tax. Estate duty had its devotees, and Ash Wheatcroft was foremost among them. A favourite saying of his, which was often heard at lectures and conferences, and I'm sure quite a lot of people here this evening will remember Ash saying this, was, "Estate duty was my first tax sweetheart." His first book, called The Taxation of Gifts and Settlements and published in 1953, had a lot of estate duty in it. All the same, towards the end of estate duty's period, that tax was plainly creaking, and a new start, I suggest, was bound to come at some time. For example, a couple of points, the so-called inter vivos period, which applied for estate duty, kept getting extended. Everyone knows the concept of the inter vivos period. It's the period where, if you died within it after making a gift, estate duty would be charged by reference to the gift. In 1969, that period was extended to 7 years, and a period of that length put a great many strains on the working of estate duty, with which, I suggest, with hindsight, it couldn't really cope. Something else with which estate duty never coped was the discretionary trust. Many of us will remember how the Finance Act 1969 attempted to tax discretionary trusts on the deaths of beneficiaries. It was very complicated, and it never really worked, did it? Estate duty needed to be replaced. CTT was the replacement. It came in against a highly charged political background, but I suggest that in the perception of the informed observer, which I would like to think includes all of us here this evening, something like CTT had to come. Ash, despite his lifelong love affair with estate duty, fully accepted this. CTT fascinated him, and one of his last books, which he wrote jointly with Derek Hewson, was about it. Is Derek here? I thought he was coming, but I haven't seen him. No. As I just said, Chairman, CTT was introduced against a highly charged political background, and certainly at the outset, it was very stringent in its operation. A first acquaintance with the Finance Bill 1975 is not easily forgotten. It caused practitioners in this field to go into a state of shock, characterized by glazed eyes and despairing shakes of the head. I remember my colleague Michael Flesh, who was here, saying the only hope was to take advantage of the killed in war exemption. Nevertheless, having had 20 years to get over that, I would like to say that CTT, in its original form, was, on a technical level, a brilliantly conceived and constructed tax. Many features of it deserve the greatest admiration, even if they didn't always receive it at the time. For example, the dovetailing of the charges on inter vivos gifts and on transmissions on death, and the concept of measuring a gift not by the value of what the donee received, but by the consequential fall in the value of the estate of the donor. But nothing stands still, certainly not in tax. Taxation is, after all, a subject which, though it's part of the law, is intensely political. There's at least one budget and one finance bill every year. Political pressures for relaxations of the initial rigours of CTT were inevitable, and the relaxations have duly come over the years. The three which strike me as the most important are my second, third, and fourth changes since Ash's days in estate duty. The first, you'll recall, was the actual introduction of CTT. The three changes and relaxations since then are the shift to inheritance tax in 1986, which is a major departure from the concept of a lifetime gifts tax, the dramatic cutting of the top rate, and the extensive enlargements in reliefs and allowances. I suspect that most of this was inevitable, whatever the complexion of the party in power, and will not be reversed, or will not be dramatically reversed. All the same, I suggest that the intellectual integrity of the original scheme of CTT has largely disappeared. In that connection, it's perhaps worth adding a more general philosophical thought. It seems to me that the importance of inheritance tax, or perhaps more generally, of estate taxation, has greatly receded. We tend to forget, or perhaps not to realize, how greatly estate duty used to dominate the world of the tax practitioner. It was Ash's first tax sweetheart, not because of some eccentric predilection on his part, but because it was infinitely the most important tax with which a practicing solicitor used to be concerned. I remember when I first started to practice in the revenue law field, a more experienced barrister saying to me, "Lad," which is what he always called me, "they don't like paying surtax on their incomes, but it's a state duty that they really care about." And they did. Inheritance tax now seems to me to be a very different matter. It's there and it needs to be kept in mind, but the teeth have mostly been drawn. At the beginning of the Wheatcroft era, estate duty occupied the center stage. Inheritance tax today is part of the background scenery. Well, I'll move on now from estate duty to the other direct tax which affected individuals when Ash was first involved in the tax system, and that's income tax. Now, of course, I said in relation to estate duty that 80 years was a fairly long life for a tax, but income tax has been with us for about 200 years, and I fancy that very few of us expect it to disappear. Income tax, as it exists in 1995, is, I suppose, just about recognisable as the same tax as the income tax which existed in, say, 1935, not so sure, about 1865 or thereabouts, but the differences are very numerous and very important. Sheer bulk of material, of course, is one of them, and the disappearance of surtax as a partly separate charge is another really rather dramatic change. But at the risk of provoking widespread disagreement, I put this proposition that as regards individuals, there are two preeminent changes in and after the Wheatcroft era, quoting from my title. One is the introduction of capital gains tax in 1965, and the other is the recasting of the rate structure, a process spread over several years, but most dramatically in 1988. Consider, if you will, the contrast between the years before 1965 and now. Before 1965, we used to have income tax at marginal rates of 90% or thereabouts, well, 18 shillings in the pound, we used to call it, and we used to have capital gains not taxed at all. Now, slightly oversimplified perhaps, we have both income and capital gains taxed at 40%. Nothing, I suggest, is going to outrank in importance that contrast or those contrasts between the past and the present. Of course, marginal rates may change again and they may move upwards, whereas for quite some years now the trend has been downwards. Even so, I can't believe that they're going to go back up to percentages in the 80s or 90s, where they rested for a significantly long time. Perhaps while I'm commenting on rates, I might add this. I have heard the view expressed sometimes that technical or academic observers of the tax system, and I suppose I'm trying to be a bit of both this evening, ought not to regard the rates as appropriate matters for them to comment on. According to this view, the rates are just political matters for the politicians, and they're not for technical tax specialists, particularly since the specialists' own pockets will be affected by the level at which the rates are pitched, and their judgment might not be as dispassionate as they'd like to believe it is. Well, I don't agree with that. Extreme rates, which a great many of us in this theatre this evening have experienced in our working times, lead to extreme attitudes on the part of taxpayers, tax advisers, tax gatherers, judges, and they distort the operation of the system. Ash didn't agree with that either. In his 1966 book on capital gains tax, he wrote this: "From a technical standpoint, it is unfortunate that a substantial reduction in the top rates of surtax did not accompany the introduction of a capital gains tax." Note, from a technical standpoint. Staying, Chairman, with income tax for the moment, there have been lots of particular subject matters where there have been very marked changes, but in preparing this lecture, I thought that it might be interesting and maybe provocative for me to pick out my nap selection for the one subject matter where the changes have been most dramatic. It'd be interesting to know what other candidates there are for this, but my nap selection is the income tax treatment of receiving dividends, where, as it seems to me, there's been a really fundamental reversal. Dividends used to be taxed as unearned income, and the sort of individuals who received dividends tended to be paying the highest rates, frequently over 90%, and 98% for the second half of the 1970s. All of this was backed up in relation to privately owned companies by the provisions about surtax directions and their successors, shortfall assessments and close company apportionments. Those provisions, of course, as we all know, were the way in which the law sought to control the ability of the owners of private companies to get out of high tax charges on dividends by not having any dividends, but instead leaving the profits to roll up inside the company. For the average tax practitioner, in the decades from the 1930s to the 1960s, insofar as there was an average tax practitioner in those decades, the most important area of tax law may have been, and I think was, estate duty, but the next most important was, I suggest, surtax directions. How fundamentally different it is now. Close company apportionments are no more. They went in 1989. And dividends which are received, so far from being taxed on the recipient with the old severity, are quite leniently treated. There's the general point that the rates are lower, but there's the more specific point that dividends carry with them a tax credit. In the old days, for a private company shareholder to receive large dividends was a tax disaster. Well, at least it was for him or her. And to make a capital gain on shares was much better even after the introduction of capital gains tax. Now, in many cases, it's quite literally the other way round. Frequently, it's less costly in tax for an individual shareholder to receive large dividends than to make a large gain on a capital gains tax disposal of his shares. There's another point which could be made, and I think perhaps should be made, about dividends and the way that income tax deals with them. In earlier years, and certainly including quite a large part of my time in practice, the unstated assumption, I believe, was that if company profits were distributed as dividends, the typical recipient would be an individual who would pay income tax on them at the highest marginal rates for unearned income. A lot of effort in the tax system, both in the rules and in the administration of them, was directed towards getting in this tax, surtax, higher rate income tax on the dividends. But more recently, tax policy towards dividends seems to me to be influenced by a recognition of a new and different reality, although some dividends are received by individuals who pay tax on them. A lot more are received by financial institutions which are often entitled to tax exemptions on their dividends, like pension funds and charities, of course. And these institutions, so far from having income tax reasons for not wanting dividends, have income tax reasons for wanting them. The effects and implications of this change in the reality, I feel, are still working their way through into the tax system and may not be fully there yet. Well, in my perception, what has happened to the income tax consequences of receiving dividends is the number one most striking change of a particular feature of income tax law. It's come about largely after Ash's time. We don't know what he would have thought about it, but I believe he would have approved. In earlier years, the fiscal consequences of the receipt of dividends could be distortive to a much greater extent than now, and the system is better without them. Well, that's all I want to say by way of generalizations about income tax and the direct taxes which apply to individuals. Can I move on and say a little about the taxes which apply to companies? For a large part of the history of direct tax in this country, we didn't have a tax specially designed to apply to profits of companies. Income tax started at the beginning of the 19th century, when very few companies existed. It applied to the incomes of persons, quote, persons, unquote. Companies were persons, so income tax applied to their incomes as well as to the incomes of natural persons. Basically, it stayed that way until 1965, though from 1937, the income tax charge on companies was topped up by a further charge to profits tax. That was the final name. Many of you will remember that profits tax started its life called National Defence Contribution. Having the profits tax top up meant that the tax rate on companies' profits didn't have to be the same as the standard rate of income tax for individuals and trusts, and no doubt was greatly valued by the Chancellor of the Exchequer, whoever he may have been for the time being, for that reason. But the dual structure of income tax plus profits tax was untidy and cumbersome. To replace it by a separate tax specifically designed for companies was plainly sensible and desirable, almost, I'm tempted to say, necessary. The biggest change in the taxation of companies over the period which I'm surveying was obviously the introduction of corporation tax in place of income tax and profits tax. This happened in 1965, very much at the time when Ash was at the pinnacle of his reputation as the nation's foremost authority on tax law, and as it happened, at about the time when I was beginning to work under Ash's guidance. He was, of course, very conscious of corporation tax and its importance, and he fully accepted that it was right to have it. My own impression, though, I wonder if Peter would agree with this, is that he didn't immerse himself particularly deeply in corporation tax. The part of the 1965 Finance Act which fascinated Ash most was Part 3, dealing with capital gains tax, not Part 4, dealing with corporation tax. The present system which we have for taxing companies differs from the one which prevailed when Ash started in the tax field, not just in the existence of corporation tax as a separate tax applying to profits. The other difference lies in the tax consequences of dividends, but in this connection, I have in mind primarily the consequences to the company which pays the dividends, not the consequences to the company, to the shareholder who receives them. There have been three main phases in this connection. Until 1965, it didn't make any real difference to a company's tax position whether or not it paid dividends. From 1965 to 1973, we had the so-called classical system, under which a company which paid dividends had to bear an extra tax burden, and this was the Schedule F income tax, which it had to withhold from the dividends and pay over to the revenue. Since 1973, we have, of course, again had a system where the tax effects to a company of paying or not paying dividends are at least meant to be neutral. It doesn't always work out that way, especially where the dividend company, though a UK company, has a lot of non-UK income, and it gets into the problem there of the ACT mountain. Nevertheless, tax neutrality is the aim, and we've sought to achieve it, of course, not by going back to the pre-1965 system, but by the imputation system with which I'm sure most people here will be familiar, and which you'll be mightily relieved to hear. I'm not going to attempt to explain or enlarge upon now. I never discussed the imputation system with Ash, and I don't think that he wrote anything about it, so I can give only my own comment. Despite the problems of irrecoverable ACT, the ACT mountain for some companies, I am unequivocally an admirer of the imputation system. It's been in force for over 20 years now, and I'd like to believe that it's firmly established and is here to stay. Indeed, I do believe that it's firmly established and is here to stay. So, John, I've given my own selection of the most important legislative developments in the direct tax field, covering estate taxes, income tax, capital gains tax, and corporation tax. I haven't included the two current innovations of pay and file for companies and self-assessment for individuals. The revenue tell us that these are the biggest changes in 50 years. Well, maybe from the administrator's point of view they are, but I do suggest, with all deference to my friends in the revenue, that they are essentially matters of administration and not matters of principle. But I think that I ought not to leave the direct taxes without highlighting and mentioning one other development which has happened during the years which I'm surveying. Tax law, as well as altering through the actions of the legislature, has altered through the actions of the courts. In particular, the line of cases beginning with Ramsey in 1982 is immensely innovative and, to the practitioner at least, of transcendent importance. I don't intend to examine the Ramsey cases here. They've been examined ad nauseam on a multitude of other occasions. All I do want to say is that there are some limits to the principle which underlies them. In particular, contrary to what a lot of people seem to think, including, as I perceive, a lot of inspectors of taxes, the cases do not say that if anyone does something for tax purposes, therefore it does not work. The Ramsey principle, if you like, is a composite transaction doctrine, not a fiscal nullity doctrine. All the same, Ramsey and its successors are by far the most important cases in tax law decided since I have been involved in this field, and I believe since Ash became involved in this field many years before me. The first three of the cases, which are Ramsey itself, Burma Oil, and Furness and Dawson, were decided in Ash's lifetime, but after he had largely retired from tax law. I don't know what he thought. I'm sure he did have views about them. For myself, I join with virtually everyone in warm enthusiasm for Ramsey itself. The later cases, I have to admit, I've never been so sure about. In Furness and Dawson, of course, there was the key extension whereby the principle of Ramsey was extended from circular transactions where everything whizzed round and nothing had really happened in the end to linear transactions, as they're sometimes called, a business transaction into which was included some piece of mechanics seeking to improve the tax consequences. When that extension was made, I thought at the time that the courts had gone one step too far. However, the courts have definitely taken that step. I well remember spending a rather bleak 45 minutes or so on my feet in the House of Lords once, while I was having absolutely no success in trying to persuade their lordships that while Ramsey was an excellent decision, Furness and Dawson was not. Lord Gough, in particular, I remember, tied me absolutely up in knots over this and just wouldn't have it. Anyway, whether or not one welcomes in its entirety or only up to a point what is sometimes called the new approach is certainly with us in its entirety, and no survey of tax law over the last 50 years or more would be complete without recognizing how significant it is. So I duly recognize that. And I move on now to indirect taxes, which means nowadays, of course, first and foremost, VAT. When Ash started his career, I doubt whether he or anyone else, beyond a few civil servants and economists, gave a moment's thought to the indirect taxes. There were import duties and there were excise duties charged on alcohol and tobacco and so on, but that was about all. Even purchase tax wasn't introduced until 1940. Well, now we have VAT. Ash was very much involved in the introduction of VAT. He was an advisor to Customs and Excise in the planning phase in 1971 and 1972. There were those who thought, when VAT first came in, that while it would no doubt raise a lot of revenue, it would, rather like purchase tax, fade a bit into the background so far as practitioners and scholars were concerned. Seems hard to believe, but people really did think that. How wrong they were. If we judge by, for example, the current flow of cases through the courts, one way of judging anyway, even if not necessarily the best, VAT now bids fair to be the tax of foremost importance to the practitioner. It's plainly a permanent system, and I believe it's been the leading influence in making tax specialists conscious in our own area of the growing interconnections of our national law and the law of the European Community. Ash was very keen on VAT. I'm sure he'd thoroughly approve of the immensely important position which it now holds in our fiscal structure and in the preoccupations of those who are concerned professionally or academically in that structure. Now, Chairman, that really concludes my somewhat eclectic survey of substantive aspects of tax law in and after the Wheatcroft era. I'm sure I've missed out quite a lot. I might have said a great deal more, for example, about internationalisation of tax over the years, but I've made my choice and I've put it forward. I'd like to go on now and say a little about the setting in which the substantive rules take effect. And there are five main matters that I'd like to highlight. First, no survey of the differences between 50 or 60 years ago and now would be complete without some reference to the sheer bulk of recent tax legislation, which has so appalled all of us over the last few years. I'm not going to say much about this because there's been a chorus of protest about it already, concurred in many respects by insiders in the revenue departments. And there's a feeling around that it's just got to stop. Leonard Baton, who retired last year as deputy chairman of the Board of Inland Revenue, said in the Philip Hardman Memorial Lecture, about a year ago, perhaps a bit less, that we need shorter and simpler legislation. And he said the way to get it is for judges to be prepared to adopt a more purposive approach to interpretation. My own comment is that the judges have been adopting a purposive approach for years already, and the revenue and the draftsmen could get started now on shortening and simplifying the legislation if that's what's needed. At the same time, I must say I have some sympathy with the revenue and the draftsmen, who tend to get unfairly blamed for the bulk and the complication of the legislation which we have now. There's not much political kudos to be derived from brevity, but in contrast, there's perpetual political pressure for special measures to deal with special cases. That pressure has to be yielded to from time to time, and special measures are very likely to produce length and complexity. The post-1975 history of CTT and inheritance tax, to which I've already referred, seems to me to be a very clear example of this, and many others could be given. All the same, we really have had some monster financiers in recent years. Ash, mercifully for him, never saw them, and I'm quite sure that he would have been as depressed as all the rest of us if he had. That was my first point. Second, a very striking difference between the tax scene now and the tax scene in Ash's earlier years reflects the truly explosive growth in tax specialisation. Before the Second World War, and indeed for up to 20 years, I would think, after it, there were really very few lawyers who were true tax specialists, as opposed to generalists who knew a bit of tax. There were a few barristers and a few solicitors, I suspect at that time, maybe even fewer full-time specialist solicitors than barristers, specialists in the tax field, that is. And a lot of the pure revenue law specialists had learned their tax law in the revenue and then moved out of the department into private practice. That wonderful man, Frank Hayworth Talbot, QC, of course, was a conspicuous example of that. Large areas of taxation, even though they were at root legal subjects, were seen as almost exclusively the province of accountants and not of lawyers. And even in the accountancy profession, I suspect that at these earlier times, tax was regarded as something of a fringe area of practice. Well, contrast the position now. All the large and medium-sized firms of solicitors and accountants have big tax departments, amply staffed by highly qualified and expert lawyers and accountants who specialize in tax and nothing else. This process was getting started towards the end of Ash's time, but it's developed greatly since. I think that he did have quite a significant, though perhaps indirect, influence on it, and that's a matter to which I'll return briefly before I conclude. That was my second point about the setting of tax law. Here's the third. As with people, so with publications. There used to be very few books or periodicals devoted to tax law. Ash published The Taxation of Gifts and Settlements in 1953, and he published The Law of Income Tax, Surtax, and Profits Tax, probably his greatest work, I think, in 1962. And there'd been a few other pioneers. For example, the first edition of Diamond's Death Duties had appeared as early as 1913, reflecting the point I made earlier about how estate duty used to be the tax that mattered most to the practitioner. Simon's Income Tax, I think, first appeared in 1948, and Potter and Munro in 1954, and there were a handful of others. But all of that was absolutely as nothing to the prolific outpouring of books and periodicals related to tax law which we have today. A law bookseller could tell us which is the field of law in which most books are currently being published. I suspect that it would be tax law. And the truth is that there are so many books and articles about tax law nowadays that no one can possibly read more than a fairly small proportion of them. That's my third point on the setting. Fourth, I think that in present conditions, a number of us are detecting a trend towards taxation becoming a profession in its own right, as opposed, really, to having some barristers who work in the tax area, some solicitors who do the same, some accountants who do the same, and so on. The Chartered Institute of Taxation, which crosses the boundaries of the traditional professions, is very important in this respect. Ash was a great believer in bringing together and getting to talk to each other many different kinds of persons interested in or concerned in the tax system. Lawyers, accountants, economists, and very importantly, officials of the revenue departments, with whom he was profoundly convinced that the others should build bridges. In Ashe's own case, Sir Alexander Johnston, who was chairman of the Board of Inland Revenue from 1958 to 1968, became a very good friend. Now, all those kinds of thing, the crossing of professional boundaries, contacts regularly between persons involved in the tax system in different ways, are happening more and more now, and Ashe would be immensely gratified about that. In this connection, I add a slightly tangential point about him. As well as having an extensive network of friends in this country who were involved in taxation in all sorts of ways, he was really amazingly good at having personal contacts with tax specialists in other countries as well. I'm not sure that since his time anyone else has managed to do that to the same extent, though ladies and gentlemen, our chairman, John Avery Jones, certainly comes very close to it. That's my fourth point about the setting in which tax law takes its place, and I come now to my fifth and last. And I want to say something here about tax education and tax in universities. Before Ashe came to this school, I think it's scarcely an exaggeration to say that no one in any law faculty in this country took any interest in tax law at all. When I became a law undergraduate in 1957, people used to make flip remarks about going up the hill to the local technical college if you wanted to learn about tax. Not that there was anyone there who could have taught it to you anyway. Meanwhile, we studied the more intellectually improving subjects like the lex aquilia or the rule in Shelley's case. Ashe wrote a brilliant editorial about this, that's to say the absence of legal education in tax in this country, in the 1958 British Tax Review. He denied that, and I quote, "a knowledge of taxation law involves learning lengthy statutory provisions by heart." And he said this, if I may, John, I'd just like to read a fairly medium-length quote. "Some academic lawyers prefer to teach a subject of little practical use instead of one of everyday occurrence on the ground that the former provides a better mental discipline. In rejecting taxation law on these grounds, they overlook its social and economic implications. Taxation is a subject which forms a bridge between economists, accountants, and lawyers, and it is surely advantageous for the legal student to realize that law is not an end in itself. One of the functions of a lawyer is to translate into practical and effective laws the social and economic structure devised by Parliament and to help to administer those laws fairly. There is immense scope for this function in taxation matters." Ashe said a lot more besides in that editorial. It's at page one of 1958 British Tax Review, and I recommend all of you to read it. The university scene is, of course, altogether different now. Many, perhaps most, law faculties offer courses in tax law or some aspects of it. Many graduates emerge from universities having acquired a taste for tax law and with a desire to specialize in it. This is, I believe, a major influence on the large increases in tax specialists and in tax publications, on which I've already commented. Ashe Wheatcroft was the pioneer of tax law as a university subject in the United Kingdom. John told me the other day that Ashe taught the first course in tax law that was taught in the University of London, in the University of Oxford, and the University of Cambridge. Of course, much of the growth and the spread of university education in tax law has happened after Ash's time, but he started it. Without him, it wouldn't have happened, or it wouldn't have happened to the same extent and so soon. I believe that the thing for which he would above all like to be remembered is his contribution to the law of taxation becoming established as a mainstream subject for study and teaching in this school and in the other universities in the United Kingdom today. That, I suggest, is his greatest memorial. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrew, for that stimulating view of the past 50 years or so of taxation. Looking back, it's rather sad the LSE was born a year too late, otherwise we could be celebrating the centenary of estate duty as well. And thank you for all your remarks on Ash's contributions to that history of tax over the last 50 years or so. I expect you were in court today arguing about the meaning of a couple of words in paragraph 23 of Schedule 26 of the Finance Act, something or others.
Tomorrow.
It's tomorrow, is it? Well, you know what I mean. But I think you've ably demonstrated tonight your ability, like Ash, to see the big picture as well as the small details. It's a most fascinating lecture, and thank you very much for giving it tonight. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
Now may I invite you all to join us for a drink in the senior common room, which is on the fifth floor. I warn you that the lifts are rather slow, so if you can walk, I'd suggest you do. And I'd like to mention that the refreshments tonight are sponsored by Ash's publishers, Sweet and Maxwell.